From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Twenty-two people were killed in an attack on Saudi Arabia, a complex housing mostly foreign oil workers. We'll speak with Professor Asad Abu Khalil, whose new book on Saudi-U.S. relations is called The Good Taliban. Then a former Baathist with ties to the CIA and Saudi intelligence has been picked to head the new Iraqi government. We'll look at Iyad Alawi. And lies of our times. After last week's apology by the New York Times for its coverage of the buildup to the Iraq invasion, more information continues to come out calling the paper's integrity into question. We'll speak with Harper's publisher Rick MacArthur and Scott Ritter about when he was interviewed and when he was quoted. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States was dealt a blow to its efforts in shaping the post-June 30th Iraqi government when its pick for president refused to take the position earlier today after being selected by the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. The U.S. has been heavily lobbying for former Iraqi Foreign Minister Adnan Pachachi to fill the largely symbolic seat. On Monday, the head of the U.S. occupation, Paul Bremer, forced the council to delay a vote when it appeared Pachachi didn't have enough votes. The London Independent reported Bremer threatened to veto any vote by the governing council if it did not select Pachachi. Earlier today, the council, under U.S. pressure, picked Pachachi, only for him to say no to the job. Then the council picked his main opponent, another Sunni, Ghazi al-Yawar, a tribal leader who also sits on the governing council. In his first news conference as president, Yawar called on the UN to give Iraq full sovereignty after the so-called June 30th handover. As the council was negotiating inside the Green Zone, a massive car bomb exploded nearby outside the Baghdad office of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Up to 25 people have died. Meanwhile, in the northern city of Beji, another car bomb exploded near a U.S. military base, killing 11 Iraqis, wounding at least two dozen. While the presidency will be a largely symbolic position, the U.S. offered up no protest on Friday when the council picked Iyad Alawi, a former Baathist who has ties to the CIA and Saudi intelligence, to be prime minister. Alawi fled Iraq in the 70s and went on to help form one of the leading Iraqi exile groups, the Iraqi National Accord. The group comprises mostly former Baathists and former top Iraqi military leaders. The Guardian of London reports the selection of Alawi shows the UN process to select an Iraqi leader had largely collapsed, placing the decision in the hands of the former U.S.-backed exile groups that dominate the governing council. On Friday, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan claimed Alawi had, quote, broad support from the Iraqi people. But a poll in February found less than 1% of the population favored him to be their national leader. Alawi, who is related to Ahmed Chalabi by marriage, has made claims that ties existed between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and he's admitted he personally passed on the now disputed intelligence to the British spy agency MI6 that Iraq could launch weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes. British journalist Dilip Hero has also reported Alawi's group, the INA, was largely funded by the head of Saudi Arabia's foreign intelligence, and that Alawi helped Saudi intelligence establish the anti-Baghdad radio station Voice of Free Iraq. In Saudi Arabia, 22 people were killed over the weekend after armed men took over a complex housing, mostly foreign oil workers. 13 foreigners died in the initial attack. The others died when Saudi commandos raided the complex in an attempt to end the 25-hour siege. Somehow, three of the four hostage takers escaped. One survivor said it appeared the Saudi police allowed them to flee after they threatened to blow up the building. Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the attacks, which have already had an effect on international oil markets. In Tokyo, the price of crude oil jumped 2%. This comes at a time that Saudi Arabia has vowed to increase output in an attempt to stabilize the cost of oil. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting Israeli forces killed a total of 111 Palestinians during May, the highest monthly death toll in 2 years. Meanwhile, the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees has launched an appeal to raise over $16 million to help repair the damage to the Rafah refugee camp, where Israeli forces have recently demolished over 350 homes, including 24 over the weekend. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights estimates 5,000 people in Rafah have been left homeless over the past 2 weeks. Time magazine is reporting that it has obtained an email from an Army Corps of Engineer official in March 2003 that indicates Vice President Dick Cheney directly approved the massive no-bid contract for reconstruction that went to Halliburton, the company Cheney headed before becoming vice president. Time's report directly contradicts former public statements by Cheney. Last September, he appeared on Meet the Press and told Tim Russert, quote, "As vice president, I have absolutely no influence of involvement of knowledge of in any way, shape, or form of contracts led by the Corps of Engineers or anybody else in the federal government." Ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide arrived in South Africa on Monday, where he plans to live in temporary exile. On Sunday, as he left Jamaica, where he'd been staying, he told reporters, quote, "There is one elected president of Haiti, and it's me. South Africa will now be our temporary home until we are back in Haiti," he said. The Washington Post reporting the Army is now conducting 91 investigations into abuse of civilians and prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, USA Today is reporting that of the 37 detainees who've died in U.S. custody, about a third were, quote, "shot, strangled, or beaten by U.S. personnel before they died." And the Army has also announced it's begun investigating reports that a number of U.S. troops have assaulted and stolen money from Iraqi civilians during patrols, raids, and house searches. A Chilean court has stripped General Augusto Pinochet of his immunity from prosecution, paving the way for his trial on human rights charges committed during his dictatorship between 1973 and 1990. On Sunday, thousands of demonstrators marched in Hong Kong to mark the upcoming 15th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square killings of pro-democracy activists, which took place on June 4, 1989. The march came as news spread three prominent pro-democracy radio hosts had quit their jobs and fled Hong Kong, apparently under pressure from China. The group Hong Kong Human Rights Monitor accused China of threatening the lives of the journalists. One of the hosts told the Times, quote, "As long as I keep my mouth shut and don't talk to you, I'm safe." Meanwhile, in mainland China, police have reportedly been placing large numbers of democracy advocates under house arrest in preparation for the anniversary on Friday of the Tiananmen Square killings. On Monday, North Korea accused the Bush administration of making up reports about the country's nuclear weapons program as a pretext for war, just as Washington did with Iraq before the U.S. invasion. The United States has said North Korea has admitted operating a secret enriched uranium-based nuclear weapons program, but North Korea denies making any such admission. North Korea's official news agency wrote in a commentary, quote, "Having worked out a plan to launch a new war on the Korean Peninsula in the wake of that in Iraq, the U.S. is building up in advance public opinion about fictitious development of enriched uranium." And Time magazine reports President Bush has a new item in the White House to show off to visitors, Saddam Hussein's former handgun that was captured. It was captured along with the Iraqi president last December. Time reports Bush displays the gun to select visitors. One visitor told Time, quote, he really liked showing it off. He was really proud of it. But questions have arisen on the web that Bush may be violating D.C. and federal laws regulating firearms, including D.C.'s ban on handguns and restrictions on possessing a firearm in a federal facility. And finally, the names of soldiers killed in Iraq read on the beach at Santa Barbara yesterday, where crosses mark the more than 800 U.S. GIs who've died since the start of the occupation of Iraq.
Robert Marcus Rodriguez, age 21. Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Minusa, age 33. Lance Corporal Jesus Alberto Suarez del Solar, age 20. Sergeant Fernando Padilla Ramirez, age 26. Sergeant Antoine Roderick Solomon, age 32. Staff Sergeant James Wilford Cawley, age 41. Private First Class Michael Russell Creighton Weldon, age 20. Corporal Michael Edward Curtin, age 23.
Again, the reading of the names of soldiers killed in Iraq. And this is Democracy Now! Islamic militants killed 22 people in the Saudi Arabian city of Khobar this weekend and held at least 40 more hostages in an upscale housing complex mainly populated by foreigners working for the oil industry. Shortly after dawn Saturday, a group of armed men dressed in military-style uniforms scaled an unguarded wall of the compound in Saudi Arabia's oil-rich eastern province and then went door-to-door, pulling residents from their homes. The gunmen reportedly separated Muslims from non-Muslims, releasing a Lebanese woman after telling her they were in search of, quote, infidels and Westerners. 13 foreigners died in the initial attack. The others died when Saudi commandos raided the complex in an attempt to end the 25-hour siege. Three of the four militants escaped and remain at large. Among the 22 people killed were workers from Asia, Africa, and Europe, as well as four Saudis and an American. A militant website has posted an audio statement by a leader of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia taking responsibility for the attacks. In the statement, he says the attack was an attempt to destabilize worldwide oil markets and the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Oil prices rose sharply in opening trading today in response to the attack. Prices hit 20-year highs in May, but eased last week after Saudi Arabia pledged to increase production and urged OPEC to do the same. The attack is the second in a month. Six Westerners were killed during an assault by militants on the offices of a Houston-based oil firm in the Saudi port of Yanbu on May 1st. We turn now to Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus, visiting professor at UC Berkeley. He runs a new blog called the Angry Arab News Service at angryarab.blogspot.com. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this latest attack?
Well, I think there are increasing indications of fragmentation within the ranks of the upper echelons of the House of Saud. It looks like the Minister of Interior, the very powerful Prince Nayef in Saudi Arabia, is really running the show, to the consternation not only of other members of the royal family, but also of the Saudi population. This Minister of Interior has a very notorious reputation for brutality and ruthlessness in dealing not only with people of Al-Qaeda like fanatics in the country, but also with dissidents of any type in the country. And it also looks like the House of Saud has decided to entirely frustrate the course of reform within the kingdom, which had largely been promised for the several years by the leadership of the country. And they are now subject to competing, divergent pressures from the United States in order to toe the line, not only on foreign policy, Arab-Israeli issues, but also on oil pricing. And, of course, the United States cares very little on issues of reform, provided a government does what it's told by the United States. The best example in that regard is Libya. I mean, here's a country where all human rights violations were forgiven, provided that the Libyan leader toed the line on foreign policy and issues of weapons of mass destruction. Also, within the kingdom, the government has been subjected to pressures not only by the fanatics of the bin Laden types, who have been linked to the royal family for years and have been funded and trained and armed by the same foreign intelligence service that you mentioned earlier in the newscast, which is linked to Iyad Alawi, the new so-called designated prime minister of Iraq. And for those reasons, there is chaos in the kingdom. A friend I know who was in Saudi Arabia last week was telling me that in Riyadh, there are checkpoints in every block. The country is, there's a lot of chaos. I met many Saudis in Qatar last February, and the ones who can afford are establishing footholds and apartments in places like Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, because there's absolutely no hope for the future of the kingdom. And for most Saudis, they can watch only in agony, as there is a fight that is being settled by two sides that do not have the sympathy of many Saudis, the fanatics of the bin Laden type as well as the fanatics of the House of Saud. Having said that, the economic problems and unemployment among the youth, the subservience by the royal family to the American government over the last several decades, have left many people, young people, who have been educated by an extremely fanatic educational system that stresses loyalty to the ideology of Wahhabiyya instead of free thinking and independent thinking on the part of students, have resulted in producing mass education that is not in any way different from the fanatic ideology of bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And this is, I mean, this is the kind of dilemma that the House of Saud is in. They do share the ideology that bin Laden has. It is only a question of disagreements over foreign policy. And we should remember, for much of his career, bin Laden did agree with the House of Saud on most issues. The disagreement happened in 91 when the royal family invited the American troops to the kingdom.
We're talking with Professor Asad Abu Khalil, professor at UC Berkeley right now. His forthcoming book is called Saudi Arabia and the U.S., The Tale of the Good Taliban. Why the good Taliban?
Well, of course, the good is between quotation marks. I was mocking the notion that the United States went into Afghanistan in order to demolish a fanatic, misogynistic government of the Taliban. Of course, the Taliban are a misogynistic, oppressive government. And I make the point in my book that the inspiration for the Taliban government comes squarely from the royal family of Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabiya doctrine in that kingdom. And I make the point that if it's true that the United States was opposed to the Taliban on the basis of the fanatical ideology that they adhere to, one could ask, why is it that the Wahhabiya fanaticism, which has been taking place for more than 60 years, didn't seem to bother any American president, including those who claim to adhere to human rights like Jimmy Carter? And the answer is, today the House of Saud doesn't have any supporters, although it is largely left uncriticized in the Arabic and the Western press. In the Arabic press, they are not criticized because they control through financial power much of the media of the Middle East. And in the United States, they have tremendous clout within the ruling elite because they are, on economic terms, very closely aligned with the United States in issues of oil production and purchases of arms. And on former presidents of the United States, most of whom have received large subsidies, if that's what we want to call them, for their presidential libraries. From Jimmy Carter onwards, we find all these presidents who want to establish their own memorial to themselves rely on the House of Saud for very generous funding for these monuments. And that's why most of the people of the United States and the Middle East do not get a true accurate picture of what is taking place in that kingdom and the fanaticism and violence that have been championed and funded by the royal family.
Professor Asad Abu Khalil, the report recently that the Saudi ambassador to the United States was told before Secretary of State General Colin Powell about the plans for war, and then the reports on the promise of Saudi Arabia to release more oil, to bring down oil prices, to help out President Bush in re-election.
Well, I mean, what I find very astonishing, having read Bob Woodward's book, is that the clout of the Prince Bandar, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in the United States, has remained consistent over the years, regardless who is president of the United States. And I should also point out that within the politics of the royal family, since September 11, this ambassador, who remains very powerful, has been marginalized by the foreign ministry and the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And there is today a succession struggle within the kingdom. The battle for the succession of the King Fahd, largely incapacitated and immobilized in the country, is already taking place. There are many factions now that are waiting it out. Some members of the royal family haven't said much since September 11. They just want to see which way the winds turn, so to speak. And in that context, this prince, Bandar bin Sultan, the son of the Minister of Defense, has been marginalized, and yet in Washington, D.C. circles and in the White House, he's one of the most influential politicians in the city, and which raises question. On what basis is the representative of one of the most oppressive, misogynistic, intolerant governments of the world is on such close terms with the United States government? And this is why people in the Middle East do not buy the rhetoric of the Bush administration regarding the establishing of democracy and so-called freedom in the Middle East. Because this same president, last year, in a phone conversation with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, assured him that the relationship between the two countries remain one of so-called, quote, permanent friendships. I mean, this is a phrase that doesn't exist in international relations. What is the nature of this permanent friendship between the United States, a self-designated beacon of freedom in the world, and one of the most intolerant, oppressive governments in the world? And the answer is, the royal family has been convenient for the American government because of issues of petroleum production and pricing, and because of covert operations and cooperation between the two countries. This is why the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia made a very good point last month, and I really agree with them on anything. But he said, for those who want to question Saudi's covert support in the past for bin Laden and his types, they should also mention that the United States was very much in bed with the Saudi government in these covert policies in much of the 1970s, 80s, if not before, as I trace them in my book.
Professor, Robert Baer, the former CIA analyst, in his book Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Its Soul for Saudi Crude, says that taking down Saudi Arabia's oil infrastructure is like spearing fish in a barrel. He said the kingdom has five giant fields that are connected by 10,500 miles of pipe, much of it above ground. A coordinated assault on five or more key junctions in the system could put the Saudis out of the oil business for 2 years.
Well, I mean, I think that the instability in Saudi Arabia is for everybody to see. There are all these signs that not all is well in the kingdom. I mean, there are economic problems. The country has been running budget deficits for so many years. The Al-Qaeda, I heard the statement you mentioned, by the way, on one of the Arab TV stations, and it basically gives the impression that Al-Qaeda is operating largely freely within the kingdom. And even if the government is still not tied to Al-Qaeda, there is at least the perception within and outside the kingdom of some factions of the royal family who are still tied to Al-Qaeda and their operatives in the kingdom, perhaps using them for their succession struggle problems in the kingdom. And for that reason, I mean, it is astonishing how easily Al-Qaeda has been able to operate inside Saudi Arabia, and the fact that they were able to flee from the scene that took place. And I've also read in the Arabic press, people have made the observation, the so-called rescue attempt was entirely botched. And this is a country which has spent more than $20 billion on sophisticated arms purchases from the United States since the end of the first Gulf War of 1991. And yet the helicopter that was used, we've seen it on TV, for the rescue, so-called, of the hostages, was more than 40 years old. Where are these up-to-date, high-tech weapons that they keep buying on a regular basis from the United States, and why were they seem to be spared in one of the most important, serious challenges to the security of the government? And the answer is it seems that they are not serious in dealing with this threat, perhaps because they realize the threat of Al-Qaeda exposes so many fundamental weaknesses in the kingdom, and the kingdom is unwilling and incapable of addressing the fundamental core of its ideology, which is shared by Al-Qaeda people, and that is Wahhabiya fanaticism.
The CIA, former CIA analyst Robert Baer, says a successful assault on the giant Ras Tanura complex, quote, would be enough to bring the world's oil-addicted economies to their knees, America's along with them.
Well, it is perhaps of the fears over the future of Saudi Arabia that the United States is setting up a shop in Iraq, which, according to some experts, if the Western deserts are explored, we may find the most proven oil reserves in the world inside that country. But, of course, the dilemma for the United States today is that Iraq is far from being stable, and America's ability to control that country is also extremely weak. And for that reason, the questions that are being raised by Baer, with whom I disagree on a lot of issues, are in fact legitimate. I mean, there are serious concerns about what could happen. And, of course, that would affect more Japan and Western Europe, who receive much more of their oil from the Middle East than the United States, where a mere 15% or so of oil imports come from the Gulf region.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor Asad Abu Khalil, professor at California State University Stanislaus, visiting professor at UC Berkeley. Forthcoming book is called Saudi Arabia and the U.S., The Tale of the Good Taliban. His website, The Angry Arab News Service, is angryarab.blogspot.com. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Andrew Coburn and Scott Ritter. Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's, will then join us. Jesse Young singing Dream of Peace with the Native American flute by Steve Juneman. Met her this weekend celebrating KVNF in Paonia, Colorado, and a shout-out to the folks in Telluride as well as in Taos as we celebrated KRZA, KUNM, Channel 2 Public Access TV, all part of this public media collaboration that is broadcasting around the country, Democracy Now! It's wonderful to be able to celebrate media that still remains the exception to the rulers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the U.S. pick for Iraqi president in the post-June 30th Iraqi government, he has just refused to take the position after being picked by the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. The U.S. had been heavily lobbying for former Iraqi Foreign Minister Adnan Pachachi to fill the largely symbolic seat. On Monday, the U.S. occupation head Paul Bremer forced the council to delay a vote when it appeared Pachachi didn't have enough votes. The London Independent reported Bremer threatened to veto any vote by the Governing Council if it did not elect Pachachi. Earlier today, the council, under the this pressure picked Pachacci, only for him to say no to the job. Then the council picked his main opponent, another Sunni, Ghazi al-Gawar, a tribal leader who also sits on the governing council. In his first public remarks after being appointed, Gawar said that he wanted the UN Security Council to grant the country, quote, full sovereignty through a Security Council resolution to, quote, enable us to rebuild a free, independent, democratic, and federal unified homeland. Last week, Gawar criticized the draft for giving too little control to Iraqis over U.S. troops remaining on their soil. While the presidency will be a largely symbolic position, the U.S. offered up no protest on Friday when the council picked Ayad Alawi, a former Ba'athist who has ties to the CIA and Saudi intelligence, to be prime minister. We turn now to Andrew Coburn, an independent journalist who frequently writes for The Independent and Counterpunch, co-author of the book Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. You wrote a profile of Iyad Alawi for Salon entitled A Man for All Intrigues. Tell us who the new prime minister is.
Well, he's a man very much of the world of intrigue. Sketching his history fairly quickly, he first made his mark in life as a Ba'athist student organizer back in the 60s, the sort of strong-arm guy. He's remembered not with tremendous amount of affection by his fellow students at Baghdad University. And he graduated from there. He was sent to London, really to keep an eye on Iraqi students, to run the Iraqi Student Union in Europe, to keep an eye on what Iraqi students were up to, because at that point they were starting with the, once the oil money started to come in a big way, they, like other Middle Eastern countries, they were sending a lot of people to study in Western Europe and the United States, and Alawi's job was to keep an eye on them. This was actually personally rather beneficial for him because he made a lot of contacts there, which you've, later on in his business career he's been able to develop. I mean, he met a lot of the people who are going to join the elites of the various Arab countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, where he has some very strong connections. At a certain point, he sort of fell out, or he shifted his allegiances and started to made a connection with British intelligence, which reached the attentive ears of the Mukhabarat back in Baghdad, who sent a gang of people to kill him in London. In fact, they broke into his house and laid about him as he lay in bed with axes, injuring him quite severely. But his father-in-law suddenly appeared, and they got scared and ran off. So he survived. That, of course, ended his relationship he had with Baghdad, but it seems to have cemented his relationship with the British. And he sort of more or less nestled under their wing through the 80s and up until the early 90s when they began to share him with the CIA. And after the CIA got tired of Ahmed Chalabi and his shenanigans, they always had a soft spot for Alawi. And indeed, he was the first stop for defecting Iraqi army officers in the 90s. He had a headquarters in Amman, and he did have connections in the officer corps in Saudi Iraq. Indeed, trying to mount a coup in 1996, for which the CIA had high hopes, but turned out it was totally penetrated. It was pretty incompetently set up, and it was totally penetrated by Saddam's security, so they were all arrested and executed without too much trouble. But that didn't sour his relationship with the CIA, and now he's emerged blinking into the sunlight to be the Prime Minister of Iraq.
Can you talk more about Alawi's connections to Saudi intelligence, which has hardly been mentioned anywhere?
Well, he's been on the he's been in receipt of their funds for quite a while. I mean, back in the as I said, he made these connections in the 70s and 80s. He's always got on very well with Turki al-Faisal, the longtime head of Saudi intelligence. There was a fellow ex-Ba'athist of his who they clubbed together. This is right after the 1991 war. And they extracted a check for $40,000. Well, they fell out after the check they'd collected from the Saudis for $40,000, which was their biggest catch to date. They fell out over to into whose bank account this check should go. And that was Sally Omar was the other guy. And they he disappeared from history, but Alawi seems to have gotten over that that incident. And they, you know, the Saudis liked him because although he's a Shia, you know, he was a Shia. He was not one of those sort of angry religious type Shia. They trusted him. He's always had a gift for getting on with intelligence people, and that included the Saudis. They pushed him. They always recommended him to the CIA. I mean, the British already had him. So he's been on very good terms with them all the way through, and it's not insignificant that I wouldn't be surprised if there haven't been Saudi funds supporting him in the last year or so. That's in contrast to his relations with Iran. He's never had much relations with the Iranians, although, as I said, he is Shia.
What about what you write, that the new U.S.-appointed Prime Minister of Iraq, Alawi, is the one who has admitted he personally passed on the now disputed intelligence to MI6, British intelligence, about Saddam Hussein launching weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes?
Well, that's right. I mean, as I say, underscores his long and deep relationship with the British. It was a one-sword, like, insofar as this had any foundation, which of course it didn't, but I mean, his reported source for this was a colonel in the Iraqi military called al-Dabakh, who passed on this piece of totally unfounded gossip, but of course it got a very eager reception at 10 Downing Street. It just shows, I mean, In passing, one shouldn't blame Ahmed Chalabi for absolutely every lie that was told in the run-up to the war. That people like Alawi also did their bit, which was of course particularly useful for Tony Blair. I should mention in passing that there's a significant appointment a month or so ago. They appointed a new head of Iraqi intelligence. Bremer did. It was a former general called al-Shawani. And just he was actually the general who was the mastermind of the would-be coup in 1996, for which the CIA had such high hopes, which was being run under Alawi's auspices. So, I mean, you can see the sort of proto-Alawi administration as being put in place for some time now in Baghdad.
Now, the new U.S. Backed Alawi, who's related to Ahmed Chalabi, my marriage, has claimed ties have been found between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, although most Iraqi experts claim no such ties have been found. He told the Daily Telegraph last year, quote, "We are uncovering evidence all the time of Saddam's involvement with al-Qaeda. He had contact with those responsible for the September 11th attacks." Alawi charged he had evidence that hijacker Mohammed Atta trained for his mission in Baghdad with support from the Iraqi intelligence service.
I know. It makes Ahmed Chalabi sound like Seymour Hersh, doesn't it? I mean, it just shows that in discarding one liar, Chalabi, they've actually promoted, if anything, an even bigger one. I mean, the difference in styles between the two men. Alawi's not so good at cultivating, or not so interested in cultivating, the press, except actually for the Daily Telegraph, with whom he's long had close relations. But I mean, from what you've just said, it's clear that he would basically do anything to please his masters.
Finally, this latest news, the developments just in these last hours. Adnan Pachachi, who the U.S. was pushing as U.S. president, has now said no. And just the whole process by which these men are being chosen.
Well, it shows the sort of, what we've seen all along, which is the sort of total sort of political incompetence of the CPA and Bremer. I mean, it's just been one sort of disaster after another. I mean, the governing council was hand-picked by the Americans, and yet they can't get their hirelings to do what they tell them. I mean, I think one person who does emerge with some credit from all this is Adnan Pachachi, who, from the very beginning, when they all moved into Baghdad and seized various nice houses and palaces for themselves, he was the only one who insisted on paying rent. So he's always exhibited a certain integrity. But, and I think, he's shown it again by having gotten the job through Bremer twisting people's arms. He's actually turned it down on the grounds, obviously, he didn't have really that. His support was not exactly deep. Razi Al-Yawar has now got the job. I mean, it's an interesting appointment. It's an interesting choice. I mean, he is the leader of a very important faction of the Shamar tribe, which is a huge tribe stretching actually into Syria and Jordan. It's got both Sunni and Shia components. I mean, in a way, it's not that bad. I mean, if you're thinking of Iraqi stability, But it's kind of odd that in the 21st century we're back to tribal politics.
The reports are now that the Iraqi Governing Council has dissolved itself and that the new post-June 30th government is now in power.
Well, isn't that interesting? Got a month to go. Are they going to start telling the Americans, when and where they can do military operations? Are they going to, who controls the prisons? I mean, things are moving very fast there. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the near future.
Well, Andrew Coburn, I want to thank you for being with us, independent reporter speaking to us from Washington. His book that he wrote with his brother Patrick Coburn is called Out of the Ashes, The Resurrection of Saddam Hussein. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, Scott Ritter and Harper's Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur. Stay with us. Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Call it a kinda culpa. Last week, the New York Times published, a sort of apology about its Iraq War coverage. In an editor's note buried on page A10, the paper declared, quote, "We have found a number of instances of coverage that was not as rigorous as it should have been." It continued, "Looking back, we wish we'd been more aggressive in reexamining the claims as new evidence emerged or failed to emerge." But to close observers of the paper of records coverage, the confession was too little too late. The issue is one which is covered extensively in our new book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them, which I co-wrote with my brother David Goodman, the chapter Lies of Our Times. During the buildup to the invasion of Iraq, the New York Times served as a conveyor belt for the propaganda of the administration, cranking out stories rife with unsubstantiated claims and outright lies. Thousands of Iraqi and American lives have been lost in a war that owes much to a media that uncritically acted as a megaphone for those in power. The sensational stories the editors refer to were often given top billing on the front page of the paper of record, while the brief apologia was buried on page A10. Compare the contrition of the Times editors on this issue with the 7,000-word, 5-page expose the Times ran last year with Jason Blair, the young reporter who'd lied and falsified stories and was ultimately forced out. The Times said the Jason Blair affair was a low point in its 152-year history. They got it wrong. It was the Times' coverage of the Bush-Blair affair that marked a new journalistic low. When George W. Bush and Tony Blair made their fraudulent case to attack Iraq, the Times, along with most corporate media outlets in the United States, became cheerleaders for war. While Jason Blair was being crucified for his journalistic sins, veteran Times national security correspondents Judith Miller and Michael Gordon were filling the Times' front pages with unchallenged government propaganda. Unlike Blair's deceptions, Miller and Gordon's lies provided the pretext for war. Much of the Times coverage in the buildup relied on the much of the Times coverage of Iraq in the build-up to the invasion relied on Iraqi dissidents, most prominently Ahmed Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress. This week's New Yorker has a piece on Chalabi called The Manipulator, which looks at Chalabi's role. The piece quotes a key Chalabi aide, Francis Brooke, as saying, "This war would not have been fought had it not been for Ahmed Chalabi." Brooke told The New Yorker that Chalabi's sophisticated marketing operation at the INC was, quote, an amazing success. Brooke met Chalabi when they both worked at the Rendon Group's Iraq Project, a London-based CIA-funded program to influence global opinion on Saddam Hussein. According to Brooke, the Rendon Group signed a secret contract with the CIA that guaranteed the company a 10% management fee on top of whatever money it spent on the campaign. The New Yorker also revealed that Ahmed Chalabi's niece, Sarah Khalil, was hired last year by Patrick Tyler, the chief correspondent for the New York Times, to be the paper's office manager in Kuwait. The magazine cites Chalabi's daughter Tamara as saying Khalil actively supported her uncle's efforts while she was working for the Times. In April 2003, after Chalabi was stranded in the desert shortly after U.S. forces airlifted him into the country, he used a satellite phone to call his niece for help. According to the magazine, Khalil commandeered money from INC funds and rounded up a convoy of SUVs, which she herself led across the border into Iraq while she was working for the New York Times. Khalil was dismissed when word of her employment reached editors in New York. We're joined now by Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. You were raising concerns about the front page drumbeat stories of the New York Times, not a year later, but each day that they came out. Can you talk about what the Times has said in the last week?
Well, it's interesting if you're a Kremlinologist to watch the Times make its baby steps towards apologizing, because what you have here is an institution that was so corrupted in the 6 weeks, 5 weeks before the Senate, before the Congress voted on the so-called war authorization, that it's very hard to understand now what happened. It's hard for people to go back, because they're seeing these stories admitting they made mistakes, that maybe they exaggerated and so on, even though they're buried on page 10. It's big news in the media world. But people don't remember the extent to which the Times made itself useful as a propaganda tool for the administration. And they don't realize the extent to which Judith Miller and Michael Gordon volunteered to hype the atomic bomb weapon stories. We know that Scott Ritter and that one of his fellow former UNSCOM inspectors, David Albright, were available for interviews to contradict, for example, the aluminum tubes canard, the story that Saddam trying to acquire aluminum tubes or the Iraqis trying to acquire aluminum tubes was prima facie evidence of a revived atomic bomb project. But people don't realize that Judith Miller was busy, busy, busy all day, all night long trying to get Saddam Hussein overthrown, and that the United States government was using her through the front page of the New York Times to promote this end. Now, until you get to the bottom of Judith Miller's ill-starred career and you understand the extent to which she's a propagandist and not a journalist, and that the extent to which the Times, through its institutional weight behind a propaganda campaign, you just can't possibly get to the bottom of their malfeasance. Now, if the Times had run a story saying one of those old man in the news stories about Scott Ritter, except we'd call it man out of the news, a profile of a man who got it right, then you'd see a newspaper that was really apologizing for what it did. Because it was absolutely critical to the campaign to drive us into war. You know, what they would do is they would leak the story, and you don't need Chalabi for this. Chalabi was just a secondary confirmation for Judith Miller. They get the feed directly from Cheney's office or from Rumsfeld's office on aluminum tubes or whatever. And the next day, the story appears on the front page of the Times, and then Cheney, Rumsfeld et al. Hit the airwaves citing the New York Times story as confirmation of Saddam's revived atomic bomb threat. This is systematic cooperation or collaboration with the government. It's not just, oh, we got it wrong, oh, we were misled. And one other point to make is that the tone, you got to read read into the tone of the editor's note in the Times and understand that the Times doesn't see itself really as a newspaper. They see themselves as a kind of adjunct to the government. A normal newspaper would say, yeah, we got it wrong, we apologize to our readers. You wouldn't get this tortured language, which in effect says, we were misled along with the government. We were misled. Our official sources misled us. It's not our fault, really, because after all, we listen to official sources in good faith. We're not journalists. We're not a newspaper.
Punch Salzberg, I had a remarkable quote, I think an editor and publisher, the trade publication, saying that they really can't be blamed. It's the government that got it wrong.
Right. And if you're not really a newspaper, you just take the feed from the government as though you were the government's press agency. Now, one thing to, if you're really interested in this subject, you can read Hal Raines' letter on the Poynter Institute website responding to the editor's note and pointing out that he was not consulted on the editor's note before it ran.
Now, Hal Raines, of course, being
Raines was the editor of the paper when all this disinformation and propaganda was being published on the front page.
He was forced to leave over
and
the Jason Blair
affair. He was forced to leave over the Jason Blair scandal, and I've always said he should have been forced to leave over the Judith Miller scandal. That's really his greater sin. But what's interesting, and this is in the category of the thieves falling out among themselves, Raines make sure everybody who reads that letter on the Poynter website knows, and he's getting even here, the names of the editors who were responsible for some of Judith Miller's reporting. Jill Abramson, who's now the managing editor of the paper, and he points out that Bill Keller and Stephen Engelberg previously had been responsible for a lot of her reporting and editing. And this is Raines just trying to cover himself and say, I'm not the only one who participated in this debacle. The other people are still, two of them are still at the paper. In fact, they're running the paper. Now, where's Judith Miller? Why aren't we hearing from Judith Miller? Why hasn't she been fired? Why hasn't she resigned? It's because the Times as an institution supported the propaganda campaign that drove us into war. For there to be justice in this, you'd have to have resignations from the top down. You'd have to have the publisher, Sulzberger, resign. And to some extent, they're right in not blaming it all on Judith Miller. I mean, in a perverse way, they're showing a little bit of integrity and not just piling on her and saying, we're going to cut her adrift. Because this is an institutional, this is institutional culpability. It's not just one reporter. They encouraged her. They let her run wild. They fomented the whole business through her.
Rick MacArthur, you mentioned Scott Ritter. We have him on the line, the former UN weapons inspector. This issue of the Times icing out dissent, of having information from weapons inspectors that at least, if not proving that there weren't weapons of mass destruction, raising questions about these front page drumbeat pieces for war, were you called, Scott Ritter?
I was called on occasion by people at the New York Times, not during the critical buildup to the war. There was a period of time, I would say, from the summer of 2002 through the invasion in the spring of 2003, where I was pretty much persona non grata with the New York Times and the Washington Post. When I did talk to reporters, they let it be known that my name was not even supposed to be published in the New York Times. The one time the New York Times did make an effort to publish my name was when they hired Barry Barak to write a profile of me in the New York Times magazine, which I think will go down as quite an embarrassment for Mr. Barak, not for me. I don't have anything to do with that story. It's his own fiction. But they weren't seeking the truth. I know Judith Miller. Prior to this time, we would talk often. I would do my best to set her straight on her stories. She would listen, take notes, and then nothing I would say would appear in her pieces. And then during the time of my blackout, there were no phone calls. She contacted me after the war, again trying to prove her point that there were weapons of mass destruction. I would set her straight on the mobile biological labs and other points that she was raising, and nothing I said would appear in the paper. Judith Miller, I agree with Mr. MacArthur, has an agenda. It's one that is not centered on the truth. It's centered on promoting Judy Miller and her biases, and unfortunately for her and the New York Times and the American people, truth is caught up.
What do you mean the reporter said you are not, your name was not to be mentioned?
Oh, I wasn't allowed to be used as a source for the New York Times.
Why?
That's a question you must ask the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. And what was the message you were putting out the few times you were called, if not quoted?
Everything they were writing was a lie. And not just a nuanced misrepresentation of fact. They were quoting, Judy Miller was running stories from this engineer, Haideri, who was provided by Chalabi, and I was able to provide five or six points where I directly contradicted him and said, if I can contradict him just on the surface of what he's saying, you can't run with the substance of the rest of that material. This is a man who is not believable. His data doesn't stack up technically. His data doesn't stack up logically. His data doesn't stack up, you know, on any of the tests that one would use. There's no independent confirmation of anything this man is saying. Why are you running with it on the front page of your newspaper?
Ahmet Chalabi, is it true he tried to hire you, Scott Ritter?
No, Ahmet Chalabi didn't try to hire me. Ahmet Chalabi was working with certain elements in the Senate, particularly Danielle Pletka, who at the time I met Chalabi in the summer of 1998, was a leading counsel for the Republicans on the U.S. Senate. Her husband, Stephen Rademacher, is a leading counsel, legal counsel for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. They were working on the Iraq Liberation Act at that time, and they let it be known that there would be a position for me that would be put together by the United States Congress on a committee that would be overseeing Ahmet Chalabi's group. So I'd be working with Chalabi, paid for by the U.S. government. What Chalabi did, when I balked at this, he thought I was balking at it from a monetary standpoint, meaning that they weren't going to pay me enough. I was balking at it from an integrity standpoint, meaning I wasn't going to play that game. And he let it be known that once he's president of Iraq, he will have control of Iraq's oil resources and that he has oil concessions that he would be able to dole out and that I would, quote-unquote, be well taken care of. Huh. That I also rejected.
Rick MacArthur, we only have, less than a minute. But on the issue of the New York Times, we don't see the right making a tremendous amount of it, though they attack the New York Times a lot, not on this issue, perhaps because the whole premise, weapons of mass destruction, was put forward by the government. And the rest of the media, very uncomfortable. They're not the only ones.
Well, I'm hoping that this is going to start a flood of apologies, that the New Yorker, which you cited earlier, will apologize for their atrocious reporting by Jeffrey Goldberg on the phony Saddam al-Qaeda link, and that maybe David Remnick will take the fall for it. The Washington Post has a lot to apologize for, although we know that a couple of reporters at the Washington Post tried to fight within the paper to do the right thing, and were not successful.
Would you like to name names?
Well, I think Walter Pincus is the most important reporter there. But the whole culture of and Barton Gellman, I think, tried to do the right thing. Or actually, Scott would know better about what Gellman did. I shouldn't jump too quickly, but I'd like to see a really good, thorough examination by all the big media, and I'd like for people like me and Scott Ritter to be able to participate in the questioning of these people, because unless you have people who know what went down in the first instance, you can't get a straight answer.
Thank you very much. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now!